Make no mistake about it, everything that is happening in the world today is because of race and religion. And the persecution caused by those two different things throughout the history of the world. I know that some of you don't agree with me, that's okay. I'm not telling you you have to. But I want you to go out of here thinking about these things and think about what is it that you really want. You want to be free so that you can be what you want to be? Or do you want to cause a situation whereby you're in charge so that you can force your will upon everybody else so that they'll get pissed off enough to overthrow you and do the same thing to you? Because that's exactly what that brings about. Exactly, it's never failed. Study history, you'll see. It's the truth.
So, it's Friday, it's 5 o'clock. Welcome to Not the BCFM Politics Show. I'm Tony Gosling. Helping me review this week's news, guess who? It's Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers. And now we're starting to meet more regularly back in a real studio here in Bristol. This is at the People's Republic of Stokes Croft, just off Jamaica Street. We're going to start thinking about bringing in, anyway, some of the local councillor guests. All, obviously, local politics is still going on. Lots and lots happening, which you'll be hearing about in a minute. In the second hour, all conspiracy, no theory. Bilderberg 2020 supposedly didn't take place because of the pandemic. But there, and guru Henry Kissinger's control of politics in the NATO countries, well, did they go away? No, of course not. And today, we can reveal the extent to which they may be able to decide who will win the German elections in 13 months' time. Their chess man to become German Chancellor in September or October 2021 will be revealed in the second hour. And also more on the Beirut explosion. Bomb, accident, or just regime change by other means. NATO surveillance planes were flying over the area at the time. How did they know to be there? And did they trigger a bomb? Well, whatever happened, Macron's visit seems to have triggered regime change now on Lebanon, because the entire government has resigned, plunging the country further into political chaos as NATO and the Israelis rub their hands. And Kamala Harris, California state prosecutor, she's going to be the running mate for Joe Biden this week. We're here, like Keir Starmer, he was an equivalent here, director of public prosecution. Starmer, by the way, quashed two attempts by Surrey police to charge Jimmy Savile while he was still alive child sex crimes, whilst also backing the prosecution of publisher and investigative journalist Julian Assange. So what did Kamala Harris get up to as a state prosecutor in the United States in that job? Also, from the last US presidential election, more on Russiagate from former Secret Service agent Dan Bogino. He pronounces it himself a lot better than I do, but he attempts to explain the backstory to the whole affair, which the Western press absolutely refused to look at. Could the whole thing be a US-based attempt at election fixing? So joining me to look at some of this week's news is Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers. Hi, Martin.
Hello.
Let me start by just asking you, have you been to the pub yet? I do hope that you have.
I've been once to the pub to eat with some friends of mine, but it was fairly low-key.
And no drinking?
I had a drink.
What do you make of the pubs now?
Well, I mean, I think that if you look at even the pubs have been open, they've got 50%, and restaurants got 50% of the usual customers. And some haven't opened at all because they know they can't make money in this situation. And many, of course, will be forced to close.
It's an interesting thing has been happening, hasn't it, as well? Because generally during midweek, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, you have a lot of empty tables at these restaurants. This week, very, very few. In fact, going into the city centre myself to have a meal out on Corn Street, restaurants are packed. In fact, I don't think I've ever seen the city centre that time of week so busy.
Yeah, but you could argue, is this a useful use of taxpayers' money? It's millions of pounds have been spent on this. And, of course, the government didn't want to spend money on school meals for kids over the summer and was forced to by Mark Rashford's campaign. Meanwhile, those who go out for meals, who are a minority of the population, are being given big subsidies.
Well, yes, but that's not the people who normally would go out for meals going out for meals. Lots of people now can afford to go out for a meal, half-price meals, basically, which who couldn't before.
Yeah, but it's not the free market, is it, giving people half prices off? I mean, it helps the restaurant industry.
I mean, you don't like the free market. You're always complaining about the free market.
No, I'm just saying that it's the government that does it, that likes the free market. But when it comes to subsidising, I mean, look at the house price, you know, the help to buy has been souped up as well, which is basically a subsidy to those who are moving house or already own a house. And, of course, at the same time, they've still got the same negative attitude to people on benefits. So, you know, there's a lot of hypocrisy.
But, I mean, the idea is this interventionist government is exactly the sort of thing that you would like to see, a bit more planning and a bit more spending where it's necessary. In other words, in this case, to make sure it's not just the chains that survive the pandemic, that some of the small restaurant businesses also get a bit of a boost. Anyway, it's a kind of compensation for the government saying to them, you've got to close.
Yeah, you could say that, and that's the way the government would present it. But I would argue that all government intervention is not necessarily right. Some of it's wrong. The question is, what government intervention are you going to be engaged in? And, of course, the furlough scheme, which I'm still a beneficiary of, is going to end very shortly, and millions of people will be claiming universal credit for the first time and finding out what a absolutely rubbish system
or
that is.
Or trying to claim universal credit.
Yes, trying to claim it.
Do you want to just give us your brief view on what it's been like claiming this benefit?
Well, the real problem with it, fundamental problem with it, is that, A, it's punitive. And B, you can't, 5 weeks at least, you don't get any money at all. It was originally 6 weeks. I had to wait 9 weeks some years ago because I was made redundant on a...
Not, hang on, 9 weeks is a hell of a long time
well,
to
it's
have
impossible.
No income. And you know what makes me think? That anyone that thinks that by going onto a benefit that they may have to... Or sorry, if they go into work and then have to go back onto a benefit is going to have to wait 9 weeks before they get any money is going to think twice about actually even taking a job.
Well, the real problem is that for most people on their uppers, the previous system, housing benefit system, it took ages to get the money through, but at least it was paid from the day you made your claim so that your landlords would know that they were going to get the money eventually.
But so why are people like Ian Duncan Smith and the rest of them disincentivising people to take jobs? This is the point I'm trying to get at. If you take a job whilst you're on universal credit and that job only lasts a certain amount of time, you're then elbowed out of it. You then may have to wait 6-9 weeks with no money at all. Well, you're probably not going to take that job, are you?
Well, in actual fact, that's one of the things that's probably quite good about it. I still have universal credit, which I claimed some years ago because I don't earn enough in my primary job.
In what way good? Just to explain that.
Well, the point is it doesn't end because you take a job. And as long as your money you're earning is less than a certain amount, you can carry on. You carry on being on universal credit. And lots of people are going to probably spend the rest of their lives on universal credit because of the minimum wages are just not adequate to pay the rent. The real problem is the gap. And of course, and because of that gap, private sector landlords will not rent to people on universal credit. And that's what a lot of people are going to find out when they go on universal credit, when the furlough scheme ends, is that their landlords will say, thank you very much, you're out.
I mean, you're on a temporary job, aren't you? I mean, anyone that's getting, for example, a six-month contract or a permanent job, which are actually becoming more and more few and far between, they have to stop their universal credit claims, surely?
Not necessarily. It depends how much they are earning. And, of course, many people in, you know, the amount of money I earn is comparable to lots of people earn in the gig economy. And in a city like Bristol, that's not enough to pay the rent. So universal credit universal credit could be a useful building block if it was genuinely universal and it wasn't means tested. Because then people would have an incentive. What happens with universal credit is you've got an incentive not to take on too much work. Because that, if you take on too much work, then you eventually end up not getting a universal credit payment. And if that goes on for more than a month, then you are off the universal credit and you've got to start again at the beginning. So in other words, what actually happens is people are being given a disincentive to take on extra work because it doesn't make sense they take it off you. Whereas if it was a genuine universal benefit payment, and of course there's a move in Parliament now, a cross-party move, to talk about universal credit, universal benefits, a universal income, and of course
universal basic income.
Yeah, and of course in Scotland they're now talking about, well, that's what we're going to bring in here. And it'll be interesting to see if they do, because it'll be very different from what goes on in.
Well, we keep hearing that, don't we? In fact, in The Guardian this week, there's a article, Our Generation's NHS, Support Grows for Universal Basic Income. Yeah. Well, it's another Guardian article explaining what this is, like we've had actually many, many articles over the last 3 or 4 years explaining this, but it still doesn't really offer any hope that this is going to happen.
Well, no, because the government doesn't want a universal basic income. because it would then change the balance of power in the labour market, and they're the party of the bosses. They don't want people to be able to turn around and say, "Stuffy, I don't want to do this crummy job." And that's why. And of course,
do you think there'd be a flood of people leaving jobs if
what would
happen? Low-paid jobs, particularly.
It would change the balance.
It would, wouldn't it?
It would change the balance of power in the labour
Anybody
market.
Anybody who's out there working for a boss they didn't like would probably just leave and say, "Right, I'm going to claim benefits now."
Well, they could do. The problem is that, as I say, private landlords will not rent to people on universal credit. So in actual fact, we're creating a deliberately... This is one of the reasons why we've got a massive homelessness crisis.
Well, let's just...
Shelter have been saying this to the government for years. They take no notice, and that's why people are sleeping on the streets.
Let's just take people's housing situation, assuming that your housing situation will not change when you start or lose a job. But this could actually be quite a good thing, because it's not good for people to be working for bosses that they don't respect, that they've got no real empathy for, and doing jobs that they hate.
Yes, and where universal basic income has been trialled in other countries, it basically doesn't. It's no more expensive than the current system. Ultimately, what's happening for me is my universal benefit, universal credit payment, is being used to subsidise my buy-to-let landlords to buy my house, which is great for them. And we were talking about free money, free meals in restaurants. If you're buying a house, the government will help you out. And the people, my landlords, are being paid by the government to help them buy the house. But, of course, that's not benefits. That's just middle-class perks. And, of course, the real problem is that everybody is, in fact, claiming something from the government, even if it's tax relief, because they're self-employed and so on.
OK, well, universal basic income proposes every citizen, regardless, says the Guardian, of their means, receives a sum of money, £1,000, for example, regularly and for life, to cover the basic cost of living. Its proponents argue it will alleviate poverty and give people time to retrain and adapt to changing workplaces, be more creative and become more active and engaged. But really, the other side of it, Martin, it is an admission that capitalism has failed and that we can no longer provide enough jobs to feed and house and clothe our families of Britain.
Yes, capitalism has failed, you are right, and that universal basic income is one of the ways you could think about trying to fix it.
But how do you fix capitalism with injections of money? I mean, just again, it's being totally reliant on the financial system, isn't it?
Well, no, it's not, because
where's the government going to get this money from?
By taxing the rentier economy. In other words, people who are doing buy-to-let should have their money taken off them. All the people who bought their council houses and then got a capital gain of £300,000 plus, you could tax all that back, because it's just a freebie. Doesn't make any more houses. But the British economy is a rentier economy. That means to say that those who own property or assets automatically get richer without doing anything. And of course, that actually undermines entrepreneurialism. Why go out and invent a better widget or set up a business when you can buy to let a house and the government will pay for you to own it? And then you can pass it on to your children with no inheritance.
Okay,
tax.
From May this year, also in The Guardian, who seem to be a sort of champions of this universal basic income, Finnish basic income pilot has improved well-being, a study finds. Well, that's kind of what I was saying, but you no longer have to work for a bullying boss or someone you don't respect. First major study of scheme comes as economic toll of coronavirus prompts fresh interest in the idea. I mean, this is an interesting thing, isn't it? Because coronavirus and the pandemic and all the job losses may even possibly force governments to take this seriously and force them to implement it.
Yes, it may do so. And of course, if it had been already in place in Britain, it would have created a massive cushion for the economy, what they call a fiscal stabiliser, like having an airbag in your car. But of course, what we've got is a punitive system where it takes weeks to get any money, and then people end up being kicked out of their housing. And of course, that's basically compounds everything that's wrong with the situation.
I mean, we often talk on here, don't we, about this sort of globalist mafia or a mafia economy where organised crime seems to be calling the shots. Actually, having lots and lots of people desperate to make a little bit of money on the side is really good for the organised criminal economy.
Yes, it is. And of course, the government has been told, basically in words of one syllable, by organisations like Shelter, that the rules they've put in place around universal credit are creating homelessness. there's been a massive surge in homelessness. And, of course, the food bank issue is, again, is another, because people get enough money to pay the rent, but then they haven't got any money for food, which is why they end up going to food banks. Now, in actual fact, what you need is a system that protects everybody's well-being, whether they can or can't work. And many people, for various reasons, can't work. Lots of employers don't want to employ them for various reasons. And this would be good. And what I would tie universal credit to, or rather universal basic income to, is participation in elections. And then you don't have to participate in the election, but you can't claim this citizen's benefit unless you do.
Well, it seems that we're being prepped for this, and maybe it's going to be a good solution. There are, just continuing in this article, another one in The Guardian about Finnish basic income. Some people said the basic income had zero effect on their productivity, as there were still no jobs in the area they were trained for, said Professor Helena Blomberg-Kroll, who led the study. Great name, that, Blomberg-Kroll. But others said that with the basic income, they were prepared to take low-paying jobs they would otherwise have avoided. So that's an interesting one, isn't it? Say, for example, even doing voluntary work. If you've got the basic income and the stuff you need to live, you can almost pick and choose your jobs. That's just almost like the way things used to be back in the 1960s.
Well, no, but then you had full employment macroeconomic policy as well.
Yeah, but that's what I'm saying, is to be able to actually choose the job you do is a massive, massive increase in your well-being and ability to play to your own gifts.
It's more than that, because it actually makes it worthwhile for you to do little jobs. Yeah, there's no point doing little jobs on universal credit, because they just take the money off you at 64 pence in the pound. But if it was given to you as a right, it then becomes in your interest to work as much as you possibly can to maximise your income. And that goes for every level. And of course, everybody would get it, so nobody can complain. Even the wealthy would get it, although they'd hardly notice it. The amount of money involved for them would be minuscule, just like a very small addition to their tax, the tax advantages that they get when they're buying houses and all the other things that they do. So it's all been costed out. And of course, because you give it to everybody, you don't have to have a massive bureaucracy to see who's entitled to it and who isn't. You just give it to everybody.
I don't want to be too much of a cynic, Martin, but once everyone is reliant on this, couldn't the government just say sorry and just cut you off? And suddenly nothing.
In theory, they could do that with anything.
They're doing that at the moment, actually.
They could do that with anything. I mean, ultimately, that's one of the things about linking it to participation in elections is that poorer people in the inner cities are the least likely to vote. Whereas if you linked their benefit to this, then they would have, they'd be put in a position where it would be very much in their interest to vote. And then they might even vote in their own interest to keep the benefit. And of course, you could change the electoral system as well. There's all sorts of things that need to be done. But I think, as you say, coronavirus has forced governments, even of conservative inclinations, to face up to the fact that if people can't work, you've got to find something else for them to keep them alive, unless you are actually going to euthanize them. And so, you know, we're going to have a major unemployment crisis running possibly for a decade now, and therefore you need to change your attitude towards people who can't work for various reasons.
I suppose rehabilitate people, because a lot of people feel like, particularly men who now form the bulk of the unemployed, for some reason it seems that most unemployed people are men. Why is that, Martin?
Well, I don't know if that's even true. What you'll find is...
The claimants, anyway.
Well, yeah, because they claim on behalf of their dependents. Yeah. So that's probably why that is. Lots of women don't claim because they're dependent on a man. Or at least it's still not entirely true, but it's still quite true. I mean, the benefits system needs to be overhauled to make it fit for purpose in the 21st century. And universal basic income could be evolved out of universal credit. One of the basic things you could change is you should get the money straight away, so that private landlords do not have an incentive to kick people out of their houses, because that then creates all kinds of on costs for government. Yeah, policing, hospital admissions, all sorts. We're talking about government expenditure there being good. Smart government expenditure is what you need to do. You don't want to waste money on stuff like, for example, helping people who are already on the housing ladder to buy a new house. That's great for swing Tory voters, but in terms of value for money, that's a load of rubbish.
In the meantime, here in Bristol, our Bristol alleged Labour mayor, Marvin Rees, is in the process of trying to bring in an injunction in the part of the city, St. Werburgh's, which of course includes St. Werburgh City Farm, Martin. I don't know if you know that area under the tunnel there and the pubs, in order to stop people sleeping in caravans and in vehicles in that part of the city. Now, that this certainly, since I came to Bristol in the mid-1990s, has been a major thing. The police are always trying to sort of knock on caravans, doors and things like that in order to try and get people to move on, usually unsuccessfully. But now, the latest attack on the vehicle dwellers is taking a pretty horrible shape. The idea is to bring in an injunction to ban all sleeping in vehicles, and I'm not sure whether, you know, they can kind of break into a vehicle to see if someone's sleeping in it or see if it's parked there with nobody sleeping in it. This we'll have to find out as the case progresses. Will be guilty of contempt of court and possibly jailed for up to 2 years for sleeping in a vehicle in St. Werburgh's. Now, that doesn't really strike me as a kind of socialist Labour policy. In fact, possibly violating pretty much all human rights of itinerant people.
Well, I imagine what's why they got the council are progressing with this is because they think it's going to get them votes at the next election in St. Werburgh's. Whether that's true or not, I do not know. You better, you know, it'd be interesting to talk to the local council.
Bizarrely, I mean, certainly we will, but bizarrely, there has been a group of people, at least branding themselves as Extinction Rebellion, who are trying to create cycle lanes in St. Werburgh's. And I would argue that the roads are, you know, not very busy roads. They don't necessarily need cycle lanes. Of course, that's up to local people and experts to decide these things. But they are getting very annoyed with people who are parking by the side of the road, saying, well, you're in the way of our cycle lane, knocking on their caravans, waking them up or engaging them and saying, we're Extinction Rebellion, we've got straw hats on, could you please move your caravan because we want to build a cycle lane here.
Well, I think what this shows, Tony, is that when we talk about the community and what the community wants, what you often find is you've got different groups in the community who are pulling in different directions for various reasons. And that's why it's so difficult to get consensus about anything, because in actual fact, people have got very different views about what they think should be happening.
And this case, of course, was introduced during these coronavirus restrictions, which means that there's a lot of people that may not have found out about it, that should know about it and might wish to contribute to the case, in fact, maybe even submit evidence.
Well, that may be so, Tony. I mean, this is the first time.
Yes, well, that's not surprising because it's not really been publicised very well. There is now more of an attempt to publicise what's going on. And I actually went to the court this week to observe it and ended up kind of being dragged into the case myself, named in the case, because I believe have an interest in, you know, whether or not people are allowed to park outside my own house. Anyway, so that will be certainly an interesting one to follow. But Martin, you've kind of dodged the issue a little bit there. You think that the Labour mayor is trying to get votes by persecuting travellers?
I do not know what the thinking behind this is. It may be the mayor, it may be the officers.
Isn't this a universal human right?
Well, in the US, many people sleep in their vehicles because there's massive homelessness. And as I've been explaining about universal credit earlier and the way it pushes people into homelessness, people are going to be sleeping in vehicles and tents, aren't they?
It's like a hostile environment for poor people. So as you get evicted from your home because you can't afford to pay the rent, you try and put a roof over your head by buying a vehicle, suddenly the council's now threatening you with Bristol City Council, and Marvin Rees, the mayor, is threatening you with 2 years in prison.
Yeah, well, we've had people on here before, as you know, who are vehicle and boat dwellers, and they've made a fairly good case that they should be given some mechanism by which they can be tolerated. I would have sympathy with that. I'm not trying to defend what the council's doing here. I don't know what their thinking is. But I think if you've got Extinction Rebellion wanting a cycle lane and other people wanting to sleep in their cars or vans, that suggests that there's a difference of interest. And don't forget, the people who sleep in vans in St. Werburgh's won't be registered to vote in St. Werburgh's or anywhere else, probably.
Well, some of them are, actually. Well, a lot of them aren't, you're right.
Okay, but I mean, in that
is this just a cynical case of, you don't vote, so we don't care about
Well,
you.
Yes, but it depends. They may have been, the council may have been bombarded with people phoning up saying, what are you going to do about these people sleeping outside my house? Now, you don't know. I don't know. It may be so.
Oh, yes, but maybe the answer is there's nothing we can do. There's no law to stop them.
Well, that's what the court case is about, isn't it?
We shall see. That will certainly, I will be following this very closely now, especially since I've gotten a little bit more involved than I meant to. on Wednesday morning this week. Anyway, so on Tuesday, there was a fascinating protest. I mean, I was in the city centre, and I saw various things which were glowing red, and I wondered what was going on. I thought it was some sort of council publicity stunt. But it turns out it wasn't. It was an entertainment industry protest, because people in the entertainment industry are getting rather fed up with being told they're not allowed to hold any events at all, not even if they've got sanitising sprays everywhere and massive social distancing. So this is what was going on this week in Bristol.
Stood in protest for their struggling events industry. These are the people you don't normally see, the ones who are often working hard before and after a show. But they felt compelled to step into the spotlight, and they fear being left behind.
Yeah, it feels that way. It feels like we're an industry that's kind of been forgotten a little bit. It's just difficult times, and it's just not knowing, that's the hardest bit, really.
What's going to happen, I think, and what I'm most concerned about is people are going to have to, by just for survival's sake, get other jobs and different careers, and if it continues next year, they're going to get more established and with those careers, and when we do get events to come back again, there's going to be a big skill shortage.
It leaves me quite anxious, not just for me, for the entire industry. To think that we just don't know when we're going to be able to hold an event without social distancing is quite scary. And it's even more scary knowing that you're not going to have the support of your government going forward.
Famous faces have been sharing their support online, and they include Nile Rodgers, whose Harbourside show in the city had to be postponed until 2021.
Our shows are only possible due to the amazing suppliers, venues, technicians and event professionals that the UK offers. Without proper support and funding, our shows and many others won't happen.
The events industry is worth £70 billion to the UK economy, but with furlough ending soon and no sign of big gatherings back on the horizon, the future is looking bleak.
These are skilled technicians with highly expensive equipment, and there are companies that have borrowed a lot of money that need to pay for that equipment, and it isn't being used. So there are companies that have probably 2 months of cash reserves left, and then it's over. Because what we do, it's our profession, we get people together, and it's illegal to get people together. So our industry has effectively been outlawed.
The £1.57 billion promised by the government sounds like a lot, but freelancers and event staff here say they need more support before too many have to leave the industry. Charlotte Gay, ITV News, College Green.
So that was Tuesday evening, Martin. The events, apparently, according to Bristol 24/7, were part of two campaigns, We Make Events, which is the hashtag We Make Events, all one word, and Light in Red, which have the message that without immediate and meaningful support from the government, the UK's live events sector supply chain will collapse. Now, this is almost like, I mean, I'm reminded a bit, actually, of a kind of Cromwell puritanical thing by stealth here, where the idea is our entertainment industry, our cultural sector, is being wiped out here.
Well, there's a number of factors involved in this, isn't there? If everybody was on universal basic income, as we were discussing a moment ago, then the crisis would be far less. But because they're not, they've got to find some other way to support them.
I mean, these businesses do need an income.
Yes,
you
they
know,
do.
You can't survive as a business with no income.
Ultimately, then the question becomes about COVID and what the rules about that should be and so on. But lots of businesses are going to go bust in what happens next. That's inevitable. But we're going to have to rebuild the economy. Now, there's a very strong case.
Listen, the ones that aren't going bust are going to be the big companies, the chains, the transnationals, the multinationals, the ones the banks are really backing to the hill. Small businesses, small events companies. But, you know, at the end of the day, this is a cultural attack on our culture, isn't it?
It's an inevitable byproduct.
It's not inevitable.
All right.
No,
well,
it's definitely not inevitable.
Well,
just a minute, Martin.
No,
we have got. Yes, well, I'm interrupting you because it's not inevitable. What they're arguing, and you seem to be taking the side of Boris Johnson here,
rather than
the local events people, in that they're saying that these events can be organised quite safely with all sorts of social distancing measures, etc., and they're just simply not being allowed to do it.
Okay, there's an issue there.
I mean, you've got a stage, for example, haven't you?
Yes.
You've got an audience.
You
there's
may
a big gap you
may find
two.
You may find with social distancing, it's still not viable as a business proposition. Without social
distancing... Well, they're saying we want to try it. We want to keep doing it.
Okay, well, that's a question...
They're being denied an income.
Yes, so the government should step in to bail out industries which are ultimately going to be viable. So there's a strong case, and you could even direct it clearly just at the small people, not at the big boys. And that would require... either to borrow the money, print the money, or get the money from taxes. And I think we've got to completely rethink our economy. We've got to bring in universal basic income, which would provide everybody involved there with a fundamental...
Yeah, but the businesses might still collapse.
Well, the businesses might collapse anyway because...
We don't want that, do we?
No, we don't necessarily want that, but it may happen anyway because we can't prevent it.
I mean, can you see why some of them are thinking this is a form of cultural warfare?
What
you're saying
is
you're discriminating against this industry more than any other industry.
That's because it's an industry which is based on social consumption.
And it makes people happy.
Yes.
So it's a joy to go to an entertaining event.
Yes, and it's very good that they've got out and made their protest, and the government should take note and give them relevant support. But ultimately, Tony, there's going to be a massive shakeout in Britain and everywhere else. There's going to be huge changes as a result of all of this, not just because of COVID, but because the banks are insolvent and have been insolvent for 10 years.
Why is it, do you think,
and
though,
at some point they're going to collapse, and then all of these businesses are going to go down the drain.
Why is it, do you think, that, say, for example, you can go in and into takeaways and you can do that sort of thing, you can go into restaurants, cafes, you can go on actually rather packed commuter trains, things like that, but you're not allowed to have a socially distanced event?
There are I've seen socially distanced events. I watched one, and it was in The Guardian today. It was an opera production in a field. They all had to sit far apart, you know, so they could see it. They're probably not making any money at it, though, because they haven't got enough people there because of the social distancing. These are fundamental problems to do
with
COVID.
I would imagine if there is a concert or something that these guys are allowed to organise, they're saying they're not allowed to organise them, that there'd be loads of people would turn up because people are desperate to go to events.
Well,
that's
a very good case that they're making, but I would suggest to you that with social distancing, many businesses, look, we talked about the pubs and the restaurants earlier, there's a 50, even with the government subsidising restaurants, 50% of the, you know, they've only got 50% of the people coming in that they had this time last year, partly because they've got to socially distance when they're in there, but partly because people aren't going out anyway for their own reasons. And that's private consumption decisions. Now, that ultimately means that loads and loads of businesses are simply going to be unviable, and that's going to happen. There's going to be more and more and more of this, and of course, as this gradually gathers pace, people aren't going to be going out because they're not going to have any money. They're going to be on universal credit. They'll have missed 5 weeks' money. They're not going to the theatre. They're not going to the pub. They're not going anywhere because they've got no money.
But you seem to be delighting in this.
No,
because
I'm not delighting
because
in
you're very much behind these lockdown type measures.
No, you're against the lockdown measures, so you're trying to turn it into a culture war when it's not.
Well, it's not actually. That's what the entertainment industry is saying.
Well, that's fine, and they can say that, and I think that would be a good case for the government to say, well, hang on a minute, ultimately we are going to have an entertainment industry that isn't going to disappear. It's probably worth subsidising.
In a way, of course, the whole media is in the middle of a cultural war, isn't it? It's being clamped down on very much. I mean, we've been talking for the last few weeks, haven't we? And we'll be talking tonight a bit about censorship, the way that, for example, expert opinion on the virus has been censored by people like YouTube. Apparently, just simply playing along to a big pharma agenda. So there is, it seems to me, a much wider, not just about the news media and TV, radio, newspapers, this sort of thing, but the entire cultural sector here is being really sat on. The idea being that there is no more freedom of expression. Well, you can go and talk in the street to yourself or just, you know, ramble or whatever, but you're not allowed to actually have an event where lots and lots of people might be... maybe even politicised by one of these events, particularly by a singer, you know, that sort of thing, an event like that.
Well, I mean, we're coming back to the big questions about COVID and what should and shouldn't be done. But you'll know very, very well why big events like football matches and so on have been cancelled, because they're super, you know, that's where loads of people can catch it quite easily. So, you know, you,
but
you
also,
can
see
what the issues are.
At a football, in a football stadium, you know, you can quite easily space people out in that sort of situation. There's lots and lots of room on those terraces.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but if you're going to do that, you're not going to get the numbers in that make it worthwhile.
No, but you may
worthwhile.
Be able to, so for example, double the price of the tickets. I mean, it just seems to me that there's absolutely, well, maybe quadruple the price of the tickets. Mm-hmm. But yeah, there are lots of ways in order to keep people safe, even though, of course, the pandemic is over, I would argue. Mm-hmm. And we're having virtually no deaths in the UK, and we heard this week, didn't we, about the even a load of people who were counted as dying with COVID-19 have now been taken off of that, which brings the actual death rate at the moment down to virtually zero.
Well, I mean, these are issues, Tony. I'm basically agnostic about this. I haven't got a dogmatic view either way. I'm listening to various people and what they're saying. But as you know, I'm of the opinion that it may well be a biological warfare attack on the Chinese, which has leaked into the West. Now, if it's a biological warfare
attack... Possibly even started here, Martin. Actually.
Well, indeed. So, in other words...
They've tried to pin it on the Chinese.
Yeah, well, what is clearly going to happen, whatever happens now, there is going to be a massive shock to the world economy. At the moment, the banking system has been propped up because they've chucked far more money at it than they chucked at it in 2008, and the stock market is kind of booming. But that is basically like a fever, and ultimately that fever is going to break with the death of the economy. And when big banks like Deutsche Bank start going down, then the cultural industry is going to be swept away in the tsunami. That's just what's going to happen.
Okay, well, one of those people who has been complaining bitterly about the measures that the government's been taking, Boris Johnson and his pals, is Piers Corbyn, the brother of Jeremy Corbyn. Martin, what do you make of him? Because we've had him on this programme. Actually, he was on the Dialect show. I think we played an excerpt from it on the Politics show, talking with Joe House, a professor up at Bristol University, about climate change for an hour. In this discussion, which you can find on our... I'll put a link up to that on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. They were discussing the topic, is climate change really man-made? And this is what he's made his name talking about, is basically a climate change denier. What do you make of this guy, Piers Corbyn?
Well, he makes a living as somebody who predicts weather. So, you know, people pay him to predict the weather.
Largely using sunspots.
Sunspots,
like
yeah, he's an astrophysicist. So he's clearly not a stupid guy. And of course, as I understand it, he's not saying that climate change doesn't exist. He's saying that it's caused by the sun rather than by human activity. But of course, that doesn't. You might still have to take similar steps, even if it was caused by the sun. But I mean, obviously, that's controversial because his brother, who wanted to be prime minister, is basically on board with the idea that climate change is an issue and has got to be something done about it. And of course, that could easily have been used and was used by the Daily Mail against Jeremy Corbyn. Piers Corbyn is, of course, and I do agree about this, a 9/11 truther. He believes that the Twin Towers were bombed, and of course they were bombed. And I think all the people going on about what's going on out there, people need to understand that's the fundamental action of the 21st century. The bombings of the Twin Towers and WTC-7 was carried out from inside the US security forces, and all decent people in the world are at war with the US deep state.
He was very, very... I mean, and maybe the British deep state and the Israeli deep state, Martin.
Indeed.
It was very kind of Piers to invite me to come and speak last Sunday down at the Fountains here in Bristol City Centre. It was covered, Piers' appearance, anyway, by the Bristol Post, and I'll put a link up to that on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. Anyway, so I gave a quick talk afterwards, but let's have a little listen now to Piers Corbyn. And I mean, he was saying certain things, connecting this all up with 5G, which I found a little bit peculiar and didn't really agree with, but anyway, that's fine, it's freedom of speech. And then you'll hear him say some of it, make some of his points about COVID-19 and the pandemic, etc. But afterwards, and at the end of this clip, you can hear as a psionym comes in and interrupts him and starts accusing him of being a Jew hater. Now, Martin, can you say something about these psionym before we hear this? You know, what are they?
Well, I don't know whether these people were particularly psionym. It's possible that they are.
Well, I've seen them before.
Well, okay. Well,
literally just trying to shut down.
What you've got is freelance people.
I mean, we had them, for example, in a speech which was given by the editor in actually right in the city centre in city council's main council chamber by the editor of the Hezbollah newspaper, and some people came up and started accusing him of them of being Jew haters as well. So anyway, carry on your point about the Sionim. What are they?
Well, Sionim are basically pro-Israeli activists, many of them Jewish, and they're not in the pay of the Israeli government, but they are essentially auxiliaries to it. And they are basically given nudges by the embassy here to go along to events like this and disrupt them, and to generally create a narrative of, you know, anti-Semitism, people like Piers Corbyn hate the Jews, etc.
But the Israel lobby isn't necessarily the embassy, is it?
Well, it's hard to say, but these people are not necessarily, the guy who was in the Al Jazeera film, who was talking to some of the people who were then given money by the Labour Party, supposedly as whistleblowers, about anti-Semitism, even though they're caught on film talking to a Mossad agent from the embassy about subverting Labour Party policy for money. There it all is. The evidence is out there in the
this itself is a massive scandal, isn't it? Because the Labour Party have completely caved in over that, and they've now issued an edict to all branches of the Labour Party that they're not allowed to put forward any resolutions about this topic whatsoever.
Well, it's going
because the party might be subject to legal action.
Well, I mean, the legal action, what should have happened over these so-called whistleblowers involved in the Panorama programme, was that it should have gone to court, because the legal advice to the Labour Party was that they had a very good case and that these people would have lost.
So why did Keir Starmer cave into that then and just because say, we're going to settle out of court, we agree with you?
Because basically, two things. A, he wants a quiet life, which he isn't going to get out of this, because this just goes on and on. And B, because to some extent, he's in the pocket of the pro-Israel lobby. His wife is Jewish.
Well, I mean, poor old Jeremy Corbyn, he also tried to do deals with the Israel lobby, and he said, well, actually, in fact, many people have said that he was treating his enemies better than he was his friends on this topic.
Well, that's right, and that's
expelling Chris Williamson, for example.
Yeah, well, this is the people go on about appeasement. This is the problem with appeasement. If you bend to people who shouldn't be bent to, they don't get grateful. They just come back for more. So, for example, the International Holocaust Remembrance Alliance definition of anti-Semitism: anybody who criticizes the existence of the State of Israel. Criticizing the existence of the State of Israel is a political position. It's not anti-Semitic. It's perfectly logical. Why should, for example, the Palestinians recognise the Israeli state when their state has not been recognised by the Israelis? And you wouldn't do that, would you? And therefore, are they anti-Semitic? No, they're not. And I support the Palestinian position, which is, we're not recognising the state of Israel unless you recognise us, which is a perfectly straightforward argument. And it's nothing to do with anti-Semitism at all. It's a political matter, like the recognition of Kosovo or Kashmir or any of these other countries.
In fact, Norman Finkelstein said that there is nothing more despicable, didn't he, than using the Holocaust in this way.
That's right, and of course he's a very anti-Zionist Jewish intellectual, but he's absolutely right. Anti-Semitism is a truly noxious ideology, and everybody should reject it. But that doesn't mean that we can't have serious discussions about political matters, about whether Serbia should be independent of Yugoslavia, about whether Palestine should be recognised as a country, about whether Kosovo can break away from Serbia, about whether Kashmir should be part of India. These are political questions, and people can have legitimately different views about them.
As is Boris's approach to COVID, and we're going to hear now from Piers Corbyn talking about that.
The toxins in your body are kept in by the mask, and you put the mask down on a dirty surface and you breathe everything in. It's a crazy thing. It's not helping you at all. And in The Lancet only 2 days ago, that's the top world medical magazine, it says, and I quote what it says in detail, short, full lockdowns and widespread COVID testing were not associated with reduction in numbers of critical cases or overall mortality. So that's the doctor saying it's rubbish. So why then are the government telling everyone to wear masks? Is there possibly a reason? Well, it's certainly not to keep you healthy. It means there's another reason. It means means there is something else going on. Of course, you say this and we're a conspiracy theorist, but, you know, there are other things going on, and we know what people are suffering from. Has there been a million less surgeries in the last 4 months? A million less, April to June. 12,000 more than usual have died of non-COVID infection. And about 35,000 have missed their cancer treatments. And we know that domestic violence at homes, killings in domestic violence have doubled. And the rate of attempted suicide in old people has gone up sixfold. And a friend of mine recently, he died from overdose of alcohol. He had been depressed and he had drinking habits. But I think his depression was brought on and made worse by COVID. Because he told me he was very depressed about it. And so I spoke in the Catholic Church recently. I'm not a Catholic, but that's where it was held. And I said, and the priest sort of his jaw dropped, I said, look, as far as I'm concerned, we have to respect what Alistair believed. He would never have worn a mask, and I am never, ever going to wear a mask. And I said that in the church. And then I also said, I noticed there's a statue of Thomas More here. And you recall, Thomas More was beheaded by the Protestants because he believed in something, namely that the Pope should rule. Now, whether he's right or wrong, he had something he believed in and stood for it. And I said, I said to the church, I said, why are all you people wearing masks? Why don't you stand up for something? I mean, what are the churches doing? They're just, well, they're bending their knee to the mega corporations and Bill Gates and the mega rich. This is an utter abomination. If churches don't stand for principles, who the hell does? And I say we have to stand for principles. Give us your name and address. What you're saying is slander. I'm going to serve a slander notice on you. Okay.
That's what you are.
So the key truth we know are lockdowns do not work.
Climate change denier. Public fucking danger you are.
Here's
Corbyn.
Take it to court. Take it to court.
Okay, so he's being accused at the end of that of being a Jew hater and a climate change denier. Well, he probably is the second, but what about the first?
I think clearly not. You don't have to agree with him about everything, about masks, for example. Him being accused of an anti-Semitism is slanderous, basically.
Well, he said he wants her name and address, and if so, he will take her to court. But obviously, she didn't want to give her a name and address.
No. Surprise, surprise.
So it was quite an interesting protest. He's also been really vindicated in many ways this week, Martin, as the government itself has said, oh, we're sorry, but we got the actual numbers of deaths quite considerably wrong because we were counting people who had recovered from COVID-19 and then subsequently died of something else as COVID-19 death. So this whole business of statistics is a bit of a murky word. Any idea of the best way to make sense of these statistics?
Well, like you and like most people, I'm listening to all the different things that are being said. And, you know, everybody's making their own judgments about what they think is right and what's not right. We've got to have freedom of speech about all of these things. But I must say, I'm not convinced by his argument against masks. I'm afraid I'm not.
Well, the independent newspaper is, because they published an article this week saying that masks are actually bad for your health, quoting various numbers of experts. Just the headline is basically, members of the public could be putting themselves more at risk from contracting coronavirus by wearing face masks. One of England's most senior doctors warns. Jenny Harries is deputy chief medical officer. She said masks can actually trap the virus, cause the person wearing it to breathe it in.
Well, that may be so. Others say differently, Tony. And as you well know, in Southeast Asia, everybody wears masks.
So, if you could just explain why it is that we've had this reversal with the figures, that's really what I was asking you about.
Well, you'd have to ask the government that. The government collects the figures and the government hands them out. Now, they've either got them wrong or they've got them right, and of course they should be criticised if they've got them wrong. In actual fact, the figures have everybody's been bandying around from the beginning. There's all sorts of questions to be asked about them. Of course there is. And nobody should presume that the last word's been said. All I will say is that in Southeast Asia, where they've had a much more successful campaign against COVID than we have, mask wearing, because they've had SARS and MERS beforehand, in South Korea, everybody's wearing masks.
Do you think that this whole pandemic business is part of a psychological operation? And if so, what's its purpose?
Well, we've discussed this before. Steve Bannon and the Murdoch press in Australia think that it leaked from the this is a biological warfare agent leaked from the Wuhan laboratory. And the Chinese have already said, well, we think it may have come in with the military games where the Americans came in. Don't forget, there's an ongoing war against China. Pompeo said, we can no longer tolerate China. So they then have a swine flu epidemic for the pigs that kills all the pigs. Then they have a bird flu epidemic that kills all their chickens. And then, cherry on the cake, this happens and we get COVID-19, which was treated immediately by the Chinese authorities as a potential bio-warfare attack. Other countries, which have former communist countries like Bulgaria, they dusted down their bio-warfare attack policies from the 1990s. And that's why they've had relatively good success with this. Don't forget, at the very beginning of the crisis, we got YouTube of Boris Johnson saying at least one country has got to try and put the case for just remaining open and not panicking, and we're just not going to do much about this at all. Of course, it's there on the record, and that's probably why we've done so badly, because we didn't take it seriously.
Yeah, but do you think the danger of this COVID has been exaggerated?
I don't know, Tony. We'll find out in the fullness of time, won't we? The fact is that we still haven't got a vaccine, although the Russians claim they've got one. We shall find out, won't we?
So we've had a massive increase this week in the number of deaths. I mean, of course, the media are not talking about deaths anymore. They're talking about cases, and most of those cases are people who don't even show any symptoms. So it seems to me as if the whole thing is being pumped up. There's an attempt to kind of keep the pandemic going because of the measures that it brings in and the control that it gives to certain people. This, of course, is massively benefiting big business and those that the banks most favour. They can survive this, whereas small businesses can't.
Well, that's a point of view, Tony, but I think in actual fact, what's the real pressure on the Conservative Party has been from their financial backers, like the airline industry, to try and play it down as much as possible and to try and get the economy functioning again so that they can get on with doing what they want to do, which is Brexit. Mm-hmm. In the US, Donald Trump has been determined to try and get the economy moving again because he's got an election coming up in November. Now, various forces are at work here. If it was a biological warfare attack on the Chinese, they allowed it to flow back over the US so that they could bail the banks out.
Well,
don't forget that in September, the Israelis were told... in November, Israelis were told, IDF were told, there is a pandemic coming out of China.
The big thing that's happened
How did they know that?
The big statistical change that's happened this week is that anybody that's either been tested positive for or been seen with COVID-19 symptoms is recorded as a COVID death no matter how long after that they died. So it could be 2-3 months even. If you go back to now, it's a 28-day cutoff. So if you've died within 28 days of either having the symptoms or being tested positive, you are considered a COVID death. So that's the big difference that's happened. On the 2nd of June, Martin, we had around about 150 people dying of COVID-19, if you use the new definition, but about 220 dying of if there's no cutoff. In the old definition, so not a lot of difference on the 2nd of June. But if you come down to much more recently, the 11th of August this week, on the no cutoff, you're getting roughly something like 20 deaths. In other words, people, 20 people dying who at some point in the last 6 months have had symptoms or been tested positive for COVID-19. But if you have a 28-day cutoff, there's no deaths at all.
Yes, and they've had no deaths at all in New Zealand for weeks and weeks, and they only had...
It's a completely different situation.
Because they locked
Martin,
down early.
Martin, can you just address this point here about the UK rather than just talking about New Zealand?
All right. The fact is, I'm not in charge of the policy, Tony, and nor are you. In actual fact, the government is making decisions with lots of advice from various people about what they should and shouldn't do. The common sense view of many people out there is the number of deaths went down because we had a lockdown. And I'm afraid that's very hard to argue.
Well, it's counterintuitive to argue otherwise.
I
don't think so. No, I think the number of deaths goes down if you don't have a lockdown, as in Sweden, very similar. It's a very similar curve, actually.
Interestingly enough, they did a study in The Guardian today. They've done a study, a cross-sectoral study, of who actually has got COVID antibodies in Britain. And they discovered that only 6% of the population have been exposed to the virus. 17% of BME communities have been exposed to the virus because they tend to live in the inner cities in more crowded circumstances and tend to be key workers. Now, that means that all the deaths we've had so far are on the basis of only 6% of the population being exposed to the virus. So that's 94% of the population haven't been exposed to the virus. If 94% of the population are exposed to the virus, you're going to get a massive increase in the deaths, I would argue. And of course, the Russians are developing a vaccine.
See, we have
because
a,
then, because
can I just
the
say,
Russians
Martin,
are developing a vaccine,
can I just
but it's
explain,
not Big Pharma,
can, Martin,
it's the Russian government that's developed
than,
the vaccine.
Rather than shouting over me, can you just let me counter what you're saying there? Because in Sweden, they did absolutely no mass testing in the first phases, so they had absolutely no idea who had it and who was spreading. It was spreading massively amongst young people.
They have done tests in Sweden. It's about the same exposure level, 6%. People were staying home anyway, even though the government
said
they
could. I know you're shouting, but I wish you'd just listen. Let me finish my sentence. What I'm saying here is that there were thousands possible. They believe something like 60% of the population was exposed. This is what they were saying.
No, they don't.
Yes, they do.
They
this
don't.
Is what the chief epidemiologist in Sweden was saying back in April.
Well,
they reckon that they had achieved, by the end of April, they were getting very close to herd immunity because roughly 60% of the population had been exposed.
Right.
So I'm just putting a counter-argument with what you're saying. Please don't shout me down when I do that.
Let's have the counter-argument. I'll put the counter argument to you. It's not clear that you can have herd immunity because it's quite possible people get, the Chinese have said people are getting reinfected.
I'm just questioning your figure from what the top epidemiologist.
All right, I'm just telling you that this is a study that was done today. It's not been peer reviewed yet, but it suggests, and it's got a random selection of people, only 6% of the population have been exposed to the virus. Okay, now that suggests there's a much higher death rate than you're suggesting.
Well, maybe it suggests that what's happened is people have caught it and then they've built up immunity.
But no, because
it may be
people have caught it and they don't get antibodies. There may be that there's long-term effects of this on internal organs and so on, which is because it isn't a flu. It's something else. It's basically a biological warfare.
Basically AIDS and SARS cobbled onto a coronavirus virus.
So
that's
something we can agree about. It's probably a biological weapon. It's not designed to kill loads of people. It's designed to kill the Chinese economy. It failed because they jumped on it.
One of the big critics in the UK has been Peter Hitchens, and here he is speaking this week, as he's on every Monday. And I found it quite difficult to get hold of talk radio. You can listen to it on the internet, fine, or there are various other ways you can do it. But to actually get a radio, I had to buy my radio especially. It's called a DAB Plus radio because talk radio disappeared here in Bristol off of DAB, and it's now you have to get a brand new radio even to listen to it. So here's Peter Hitchens speaking this week about King Canute, Martin, a bit of history which I imagine that you will be able to argue with Peter Hitchens about after we've heard him.
There's so much of this has seemed to me to be ignoring the great lesson of King Canute's struggle against the tide, which is, I don't think, any more even taught in schools. People don't understand what it was, and you can tell from the way people behaved what he was demonstrating when he set his throne up on the seashore and ordered the tide to go back. He was demonstrating to his courtiers, there are some things governments just can't do, kings can't do. I can't command the tide. No more can governments command the spread of a virus, which by its nature is going to get through almost all human defenses and has done and does. What we now have with testing is a constant excuse for the government to claim that things have not got any better. Completely astonishes me about this is that people take it seriously.
Yeah.
Anybody looking at the figures, you can go to Statista, one very important website, which does the deaths per million in every country, or you can go to the coronavirus worldometer, and you can look at the state of play in every single country in the world, and what you'll find is that in most countries, the number of people dying from coronavirus has dropped enormously from where it was, particularly in the European countries, I should say, enormously from where it was in April, and the deaths are very much lower. So what these tests are showing, things which are grandly called cases and infections, are positive tests. If you then look at the figures for hospitalizations and deaths, you'll find that there's almost no connection between the level
no.
of, of positive tests and hospitalizations, let alone deaths. Most of these people have either very mild symptoms or no symptoms at all.
Right.
So what does it mean? Why, what it's actually showing, if you look at it rationally, and if you stop and think for just a moment, is that actually the disease is not that serious.
Well, that's the thing. I mean, I was just talking to Carol Sikora, who said, the lockdown in Leicester is over. I said, were there any additional deaths or increased hospital admissions? He said, no.
Yeah.
You know, it's
We discussed this. I mean, the figures about increased cases in Leicester followed an eightfold increase in the number of testing centres.
Yeah.
And this just happens over and over again. And you look at the number of tests conducted, for instance, in New South Wales or Victoria in Australia, and they've gone up enormously. And good heavens, they found an awful lot more so-called cases, so-called infections. And this, along with a very small number of deaths, most of them, regrettable as all deaths are, but nonetheless it's important to note this, most of them among very old people who were already quite ill, has been used as a pretext for shutting down the entire vast city of Melbourne.
Yeah.
In the most extraordinary state of emergency, such as one might normally see at a time of invasion.
Mm.
And it's completely ridiculous and disproportionate. But what, again, there is no, the Parliament doesn't exist, and the media seems to have checked its brains in somewhere and forgotten the ticket.
Well, Peter Hitchens saying quite a lot there, Martin, but what about his point about King Canute? Is he right? Is that what King Canute was actually up to?
Well, the story about King Canute and the waves is a story. It's in the Anglo-Saxon Chronicle, whether it actually happened or not, modern historians would say,
rather than arguing about whether it happened, well, let's assume it did for a moment. What was the point? I mean, he seems to be saying there that there are things that governments just simply cannot do anything about or try to do too much about, overstretch their abilities. And that's actually quite a good point old King Canute was making there.
Well, let's leave King Canute out of it, and let's just talk about Peter Hitchens.
What he says, rather than some sort of personal.
No. The point about Peter, he's basically a small government man, like many conservatives. He doesn't think governments can do anything very much, so he's generally in favour of governments not trying to do things. The logical conclusion from his position is that the government should have done nothing at all about COVID-19, and that comes back to Boris Johnson's interview where
I think you're overstretching the point. Nothing at all.
No, if government can't do anything, it can't do anything.
Just a minute. What you're doing is you're just misrepresenting completely there. Mm-hmm. What he's suggested all the way along, right back from March, is that we should be following something more like a Swedish model.
Okay, let's
government in Sweden did not do nothing at all, did it?
No, yes, and lots of people stayed home anyway, even though they were allowed to go out.
What happened is that they had, I think, is quite an intelligent look at the vulnerability of people to this, how dangerous it was, and by the way, in terms of its lethality, it was something around the same lethality as a particularly nasty strain of flu. That's certainly what it seems to me. And, from all the stuff I've read around this, and that what you do is you target a specific part of the population that are most likely to be vulnerable to it, and what you do is you somehow separate those from the rest of society, somehow quarantine and let the rest of society who are not vulnerable to it catch it, including children. And we had a few weeks ago on this programme surveys both from France and Germany proving that it was not possible for children to be spreading this in schools, even to teachers, the French found out. So there is definitely much less possibility of COVID-19 being spread by young people than old people. So it makes perfect sense to separate the two, to say, well, you lot, we don't need to destroy your lives and smash your businesses up. You're younger, but elderly people we will protect.
Okay, I'm not going to get into an argument about this because I'm not an expert about it any more than Peter Hitchens.
Neither am I. Reading around.
I'm reading around as well. What seems to me to be the case is that there's an awful lot of don't knows here, or Rumsfeld's unknown unknowns, and that's why some countries have been more cautious, other people's less so. Incidentally, the chief guy in Sweden was not very happy about what they've been doing in Britain. He's saying what we decided to do was a long-term plan. Yeah, so we're not going to release the football's not coming back anytime soon in Sweden, but we didn't close down the restaurants. Yeah. Now, in other words, that's the point that they decided at the beginning, was they wanted something that they could carry on doing for a long time without changing it. Yeah, what we've done in this country is we did nothing at all, then we decided we were going to do loads of stuff, and then decided we couldn't do that, and we're all over the place.
Now, what they've done is they've said anyone can do pretty much what they want in their own city, so you can have a local lockdown in Scotland or Wales or in a city, and so it's almost like the Lords of Misrule, complete chaos. No one really knows what they're supposed to do.
And you know why they're doing that, Tony, is because they know that if there is a big spike and a lot of deaths over the winter, it'll be Bristol City Council to blame, not Boris Johnson and his government. That's what they're trying to do there.
Our next story on the COVID is, I think it's important, you know, constantly to look back at the work of Dr. Andrew Wakefield, because we were covering him on this show, Martin, weren't we, like 4 or 5 years ago, looking at his work on the very legitimate criticism of the pharmaceutical industry and their lobbying of government and their lobbying of the regulation, particularly of vaccines, when it comes to it's not really fair to call him a vaccine denier, or many people are smeared with this, like almost like a Holocaust denier or something. Mm-hmm. But what he's effectively saying is, he's very, very clear. Some vaccines are very effective, and I would prescribe them to my patients, and I would advise my patients to have them. But when you have gone through the approval process for a vaccine, and you're doing two things which should never be done. One is that you're giving them to infants, like newborn children, when they haven't actually been tested on those kids with, a control group as well. And the other one is when they're put into multiple shots. Because I can remember very well speaking to some of the surviving victims of Gulf War syndrome after the first Gulf War in 1990, Martin, who said basically what we were given was a load of shots and then we were never the same again. And many of my colleagues died as a result. And all those individual vaccines may be okay as an individual vaccine or a shot of an inoculation of some sort. But when you put them all in one, your body can't cope.
Yes, and of course that was all because Saddam had weapons of mass destruction, which he didn't turn out to have at all, because they'd all been dismantled.
That was the 2003 rule. I'm talking about the invasion of Kuwait back in 1990 for the Gulf War syndrome.
Yeah, well, he didn't use nuclear. He didn't use weapons of mass destruction then either, because he knew if he did, there was actually a B-52 bomber flying over Baghdad full of nuclear weapons, and if they'd used anything like that, they'd have nuked Baghdad. And that's, you know,
in the first Gulf War, though, that was, he was tricked, wasn't he, by April Glasby into invading Kuwait. The ambassador said to him, look, if you invade Kuwait, no problem, we're not going to be bothered, because we can see that those nasty Kuwaitis are stealing your oil. Go and invade them, and we'll pat you on the back, and we will help supply you with weapons.
Well, that's right. And of course, he invaded Iran back in 1980 because that's what the Americans and the British wanted him to do. He was the blue-eyed boy in those days.
He was their sort of cat's paw, really, wasn't he?
Absolutely.
In that region.
And a bit like what's happened with Lukashenko in Belarus, which I've been talking about this week on RT, is he was starting to play footsie with the West and saying, I'm quite interested in getting friendly with you and pulling away from the Russians. And of course, he's been rewarded with a color revolution.
Okay, well, I'm sorry for going off on a bit of a tangent there about Gulf War syndrome, but it's extremely important in understanding the danger of putting multiple vaccines into any person, especially a healthy soldier in their 30s or 40s or 20s. But what about putting it into a newborn infant? This is unbelievable. Anyway, Andrew Wakefield, who's no longer a doctor, he was struck off by the General Medical Council, like our guest Dr. Adil was last week. He's much more recently struck off for speaking out about COVID-19. But anyway, let's have a listen to Andrew Wakefield now in this little clip of a documentary, quite an old documentary, called Shots in the Dark, Silence on Vaccines.
What is taking place in the intestine of children with autism? What has been demonstrated is indicative of an inflammatory or disease process. And what we find in the children with autism is that this area, the lymph glands, if you like, of the intestine, become greatly swollen, as they do in children with food allergy or infection, that there is inflammation. So the numbers of these immune cells infiltrating into the bowel is greater in the children with autism. Now, lining the surface of the intestine are enzymes that digest our food. If those aren't working properly, which happens in children when they have inflammation of the bowel, then certain undigested molecules can get through. And some of those molecules will have neurotoxic activity. They are toxic to the brain. And certain molecules, such as those derived from gluten, in wheat or from dairy products, casein, have morphine-like activity, very powerful opioid activity. And if they get in, do they then influence the development of the brain? It's biologically plausible, and it's something that needs to be examined. So is it possible that in some children with autism, inflammation in the intestine, perhaps due to a measles virus infection or some other infection, is setting the scene for a secondary activation of the immune system in the brain?
Your child gets a shot or you go to jail. That get tough policy right now in Prince George's County, Maryland. Today is the deadline for parents to get their children state-mandated vaccinations. Prove they've already done it or possibly face up to 10 days in the joint. Hundreds of anxious parents showed up at the county courthouse today for on-the-spot shots. Officials call the policy a last resort. Critics say it goes way too far.
You can't say no, because they'll put you in jail. They'll come arrest you for child abuse. They'll take your child away. They won't let them go to school. But it's got a black box warning, so they told you it could cause it. But if you don't agree to it, that's not, you cannot have informed consent when you have mandatory vaccines. If you got a problem, you got to make it optional, then you got informed consent.
The pharmaceutical industry is probably the most powerful lobbying force in Washington, D.C. There are 535 members of Congress, the House and the Senate. There are over 600 lobbyists for the pharmaceutical industry. They are a very powerful force. They give a lot of money to both political parties. They give a lot of money to individual candidates. They don't give me any. But they give an awful lot of money to various candidates. And they have a very strong lobbying effort. And so getting anything done in Congress that pharma, the pharmaceutical industry, doesn't want done is very, very difficult. That is one of the problems. The other problem is they have very, very strong influence with the Food and Drug Administration and Health and Human Services and CDC. And because of their strength, it's very difficult to get change made.
So that's an excerpt from the documentary Shots in the Dark, Silence on Vaccines. And ever since we started looking at Andrew Wakefield's work, Martin, it's been the same story, really, hasn't it? The power of the pharmaceutical industry, the overarching power. And of course, this combined with things like the tax-free foundations, like the Gates Foundation, it's very difficult for politicians to resist this. What we were hearing a few weeks ago is the most powerful lobby in the world.
It is, and there's no doubt about it that they have far too much power. I mentioned earlier the Russian vaccine for COVID-19, which of course is still in an experimental stage, but that's been developed by the Russian government, and therefore they're not part of the same game as the Western pharmaceutical companies any more than the Cuban health services or the Chinese health.
Well, maybe the Russian government wants to make some money out of this.
Well, they may be saying if we can get the vaccine first, we can make money out of it. But in fact, both China and Russia have said that they're going to develop a vaccine as a public benefit.
Now, so they're not going to charge for it?
Well, they'll charge costs for it. That's presumably the idea.
Well, maybe this is a lost leader, and they'll be trying to get the subsequent booster shots.
Don't forget that even if they have that kind of policy, they're in competition with the Western pharmaceutical industry, which is profit-based and all the rest of it. I think these are quite abstruse questions. You've got to have some kind of expert opinion, which is basically to be trusted, because you've made sure you've insulated it from these pressures. Now, I totally accept that the modern Western so-called democratic system is nothing of the kind, and that in actual fact the people behind the scenes and organisations behind the scenes who are able to steer things in the directions that they want them to go. But you can't necessarily extrapolate that to other systems which function on a different basis. And the fact that non-Western countries have taken this virus seriously and have definitely looked at it as a threat, that suggests to me that it isn't just Bill Gates pushing his agenda. There's also other people who've not got any skin in that game who are looking at it and wondering what the hell is this.
It does seem as if we're in a situation now where nothing's going to be allowed to return to normal.
Well, it can't anyway, because the banks collapsed in September last year, and we've printed so much money now that the stock market's going up.
I'm talking in terms of the various virus measures.
Well, the virus measures will ultimately be successful or not successful, but the economy has been messed completely. What happened in 2008 was we bailed the banks out and we said, right, that's never going to happen again. Get your act together, get yourselves in order. We're not going to do that again. And, of course, what this virus has done is it allowed them to do exactly the same thing all over again. And they started collapsing in September. In November, the IDF in Israel were told there's a pandemic coming out of China. And then from November to December, it all starts to happen. That's the sort of thing that we're going through the mind of the Chinese intelligence services.
On the local economic scene, a fascinating article here by Ellie Pipe in Bristol 24/7 this week. The criticism of how Bristol Energy sale has been handled. Now, we've been covering Bristol Energy, a long time, last couple of years. We had estimates from Tim Kent from the Liberal Democrats, who's one of the city councillors, saying he reckons around 40 or 50 million pounds of public money has been poured down the drain with the help of Bristol Energy. And we're hearing now that, I mean, last report we heard was a month or so ago, maybe 2 months even ago, where the city council was saying, well, we're going to try and sell this now. Now, of course, the idea is the mayor, Marvin Rees, after, you know, basically swearing that he would keep this thing going, and it was all going to turn around, etc., has finally realised it's a total disaster and he wants to get it off his hands and our hands by the time of the next election, because he's got his unelected year at the moment. He didn't have to stand for re-election in May. So in May 2021, we hope there will actually be an election for mayor here in Bristol. Opposition councillors, Martin, responded to the sale of the business side of Bristol Energy with criticism of the way the whole saga has been handled. It was announced on Monday that U Energy, YU, with some sort of weird dots over the U, has acquired 4,000 accounts from the troubled company for $1.34 million, a sum branded paltry by the Green mayoral candidate Sandy Hall Ruthven, blamed the Labour administration for being too secretive. The deputy leader of Bristol's Tory councillor group, Claire Hiscock, called the sale a necessary step to ending the council's involvement. But it's a bit too little too late, isn't it? We've been pouring money down the drain. 36.5 million is the official figure since its launch in 2015, Martin.
Well, as I say, I don't actually know that much about this other than discussions we've had on this show about it. I think there's obviously a consensus now that this has, that it didn't work.
Marvin, the mayor, has been forced to pull the plug, even though he himself has been backing it during his entire term as mayor.
Well, then he will have to defend that, won't he, when it comes to the election. But the fact is that virtually all the political groups on Bristol City Council have had a hand in putting this energy company together.
It's not entirely fair, because for the last 4 years they've been all been saying, look, we need to pull the plug on this, something needs to change, because we're just pouring good money after bad.
Yes, well, I mean, and I think that it's quite clear that the current administration now agrees.
Finally, the mayor has caught up. What about the way that this whole thing has been handled? We've got Bristol Waste, to Bristol Energy and the Bristol Housing Company, all part of one of these arm's length organisations. A very strange way to do things, it seems to me. You've got a private company which is really unaccountable. None of the public can come and see what they do and sit in on their board meetings, etc. The old way these so-called public businesses were run was they would be run by a council committee with councillors as the directors, maybe one or two other people seconded on there, but the public would be able to sit there and watch how it was run. These have all been run in secret.
Yes, and of course there's a general consensus. Don't forget I used to be a social economy development worker for the council. There's a general consensus that if you sat up these arm's length organisations, that somehow they're going to be better than running stuff in-house. And, as you've just pointed out, that's not necessarily the case at all. It actually allows all sorts of unaccountable behaviour to take place, just like housing associations, which eventually, become, they're not accountable in the same way that council house tenants can hold the council to account for what sort of service they get. And it was part of a whole, we're getting away from centralised control, getting away from socialist planning. We're going to allow pseudo-markets in these various things to operate, which is going to be much more flexible and so on than running it directly by the council. But, of course, ultimately what it means is you end up throwing good money after bad, potentially, in all three cases.
Another story we've covered for quite a while now is Lloyds Bank's Castle Park branch. Noel Edmonds has quite famously been criticising them for several years. He seems to have gone quiet now because he's come to a nice settlement and they've paid him off. But this isn't justice, Martin, is it? Someone who's wealthy, powerful, well-organised as Noel Edmonds has managed to get his compensation, but there are hundreds more who've been cheated, allegedly, by Lloyds Bank Castle Park branch, where, for example, they've had their overdraft facilities contracts altered, that they've been not told how much they owe them, etc., in a bamboozling fashion by Lloyds. So a little bit of a bit of news on that one. A fresh row is threatening to spoil Antonio's swan song. The Lloyds boss admits he knew of alleged fraud at HBOS Bristol. And this is Lucy White writing for the Daily Mail this week. She says that another scandal is threatening to engulf Lloyds Bank's boss, Antonio Horta Osorio, Portuguese guy, before he signs off next year. The chief executive admitted he knew of an alleged fraud at HBOS Bristol branch, which may have affected hundreds of small business customers. Lloyds may now face a criminal inquiry over events in Bristol, which could drag him figures, including his nibs. Horta Osorio. This is fascinating because it's a kind of local version of what's been going on in the big wide banking world, where there are literally frauds taking place by the bankers themselves, Martin, and they seem to be getting away with it scot-free.
Well, they do all sorts of nasty stuff, but one of the things they do, and RBS were convicted of this as well, weren't they, is they basically call loans in, and then they get the assets of the people concerned, which can then go to pay off the massive losses that they made in the financial crisis in 2008. And, of course, none of these banks, none of them would exist, including Barclays, which didn't directly take government money but went to Saudi Arabia instead. But the system is a system. So if you allow big banks like RBS to go down, all of them should have been bankrupted. But here we are, years later, and they're still doing all of this stuff. Extraordinary, isn't it?
We've also been covering redundancies at the BBC, which for a while were halted due to the virus, but now apparently it's all going through, slowly but surely, crunching through. How are they going to decide who they're going to get rid of and how? But this is at the Bristol Post. Newspaper job cuts, a threat to democracy. Redundancies at two local newspapers pose a grave threat to Bristol's democracy. All nine news reporters at the Bristol Post are at risk, along with all staff at the Western Daily Press. Fewer journalists means fewer people to question those in power, a spokesperson for the National Union of Journalists said. I imagine that's the London branch or the London office. Reach, that's the people who own this. By the way, Reach PLC seem to own loads of things, don't they? They own the old Daily Mail local newspapers and the old Daily Mirror local newspapers, because you used to have the Mirror and the Mail both used to have regional newspaper arms. They're now all one, and it's something called Reach PLC as one newspaper, amazingly. But anyway, Reach continues to consult with colleagues and trade unions over the proposed changes, which are subject to a minimum 45-day statutory consultation period. Pandemic has seen significant declines in advertising. These changes are required and about us operating more efficiently to protect local journalism and our news brands for the long term. Now, that's what they say. What I say is you're using the pandemic as an excuse for asset stripping and destroying our ability to know what's going on in the city, basically denuding democracy.
Yes, quite likely. But I'm afraid there's lots more redundancies to come, and not just in the media. We've been given a big shot of heroin by Rishi Sunak at the beginning of the year, and now we're going to have to go cold turkey, and lots of people are going to be flapping around the place and squawking.
Well, with the ownership of these, you have to keep track of who owns these papers. The Daily Mirror and the Daily Express are very different editorial lines, but they're both owned by the same company.
Well, I don't know that much about the
But I mean, that's interesting, isn't it? It's almost as if one person wants to be almost speaking out of two sides of their face.
Well, in actual fact, that's relatively benign. It means that they're not that bothered about what's said as long as they're making money. Of course, you've got people like Rupert Murdoch, who's got more money than he knows what to do with, who are pushing the line that the Chinese deliberately created the coronavirus to crash the US economy, and Steve Bannon is saying that they've got insiders from the Wuhan laboratory that are going to bring all this out before November, when Trump has to go to the electorate. You know, would you rather have media owners who are not that bothered about what their various titles say, provided they make some money, or people like Murdoch who determined to push his agenda?
Very interesting as well, I think, that Mike Norton, who's been the editor of the Bristol Post for 15 years or so, has also left his job. Doesn't seem as if that is a voluntary thing. He's certainly not at retirement age or anything like that. My inquiries into why he was sacked or has left, and it says here he's left, I would assume he's been probably elbowed out, because that's the way these things usually happen. Whether or not it's connected to the enormous criticism that he gave to Marvin Rees, the mayor here, over the bullying of one of his journalists back in, I think it was in January, Adam Postans, who was a local Democracy reporter, actually his wages paid by the BBC, I believe, from the licence fee, and his articles are shared on the Bristol Post and on the BBC and elsewhere around the city, where the mayor was, Adam came in to report on one of the meetings, the mayor and some of the senior cabinet people all said, oh, it would be nice if there was a journalist in the room, and they started laughing at the guy. Mike Norton then backed him, and that article basically explaining that this was not acceptable behaviour by the mayor, even by his own city council's rules, that got into the whole national journalistic press, Martin, all journalists all over the country having a look and to see what the mayor Marvin Rees was doing to journalists in cabinet meetings who were trying to cover his cabinet meetings.
Well, that's definitely an allegation, Tony. It would be interesting to get Mike in to see what his opinion is on that.
Well, we're certainly working on that. We'll see how we go. And I think there's one little final story we've got here. Oh, gosh. Yes, that's right. It's to do with the pandemic. And this is a kind of, I suppose, almost a massive potential conspiracy going on. This is the needtoknow.news website reporting that a report by the Rockefeller Foundation has basically spelled out much of what we're seeing during this pandemic. Back in 2010, 10 years ago, the report in question has the bland title, Scenarios for the Future of Technology and International Developments, Lockstep. It was published in May 2010 in cooperation with the global business network of futurologist Peter Schwartz. The report contains various futurist scenarios developed by Schwartz and his friends. One scenario carries the intriguing title Lockstep, a world of tighter, top-down government control, a more authoritarian leadership with limited innovation and growing citizen pushback. Here it gets interesting, as in what some term predictive programming. The Schwartz scenario states, in 2012, the pandemic that the world has been anticipating for years has finally hit. Unlike 2009's H1N1, this new influenza strain, originating from wild geese, was virulent and deadly. Even the most pandemic-prepared nations were quickly overwhelmed when the virus streaked around the world, infecting nearly 20% of the population and killing 8 million in just 7 months. He continues, the pandemic had also a deadly effect on economic international mobility. And on economies, international mobility of both people and goods screeched to a halt, debilitating industries like tourism and breaking global supply chains. Even locally, normally bustling shops and office buildings sat empty for months, devoid of both employees and customers. This sounds eerily familiar. The scenario then gets very interesting. During the pandemic, national leaders around the world flexed their authority and imposed airtight rules and restrictions, from the mandatory wearing of face masks to body temperature checks at the entries to all communal spaces like train stations and supermarkets. Even after the pandemic fades, this more authoritarian control and oversight of citizens and their activities stuck and even intensified. In order to protect themselves from the spread of increasingly global problems, from pandemics and transnational terrorism to environment crises and rising poverty, leaders around the world took a firmer grip on power. Now, I mean, he's seeing it as a sort of a pandemic, as a excuse for concentrating power into fewer and fewer hands.
Well, let's get clear what this is. This is a projection for the future from 2010 by a futurologist. Now, in actual fact, anybody who knows anything about futurology, and you know the integrated nature of the modern global economy, a pandemic of some sort was virtually inevitable. Just think about, when I think back in the 1970s, the first time I got on an aeroplane to fly to Ireland was in 1983. And now, children in my in the schools I work in go flying off to holidays all over the world every year. Ultimately, that makes society much more vulnerable to this kind of pandemic.
Let's just have you say this kind of pandemic, but let's just look compare this to the 2017-2018 flu. There we had 50,000 extra deaths due to that flu over that winter. Mm. We've just had it downgraded in this country by 5,000. We're now at 40,000 deaths of people with COVID-19 in the UK. So that is actually quite considerably less than the flu was back in 2017-2018. And yet we've had absolutely unprecedented measures, and I would suggest a whole media hysteria around this that we've never seen the like of it ever in the history of the planet.
Okay, well, let's just unpick this. The case you're making is that there's been an overreaction to this particular pandemic. That's a fairly logical point. You can agree or disagree.
And if you trace back where that came from, particularly here in the UK, you can look at Neil Ferguson and also Imperial College, is directly funded by these same people, the Rockefeller Foundation.
I know that I'm very familiar with what the argument is, but I'd also point out that they don't have much power in places like China, and the Chinese have got their own views on all of this. They think that they're potentially under attack from the West with a biological attack, so they prepare to defend themselves against it. The same with Cuba, the same with North Korea, the same with Kerala in southern India, which is run by communist government, elected communist government. They've all adopted very strong measures.
We seem to be, and many people are arguing, we seem to be moving towards more of a Chinese system where we may be actually saying, well, if you haven't had a vaccine, if you're not doing X, Y, and Z, then you're a lower class citizen. Exactly the same sort of thing we've seen with the social credit system in China.
Yes. And what the Chinese would say is we've dragged a quarter of the world's population out of poverty in the last 30 years. Meanwhile, you've just had your banks blow up, which nearly destroyed the living of people all over the world. There is a contest between your system and our system. And as you can see in the United States, the social structure is fragmenting rapidly.
Dragging people into factories isn't necessarily the same as dragging them out of poverty. Certainly, if you look at the financial side of it, yes. But actually, when it comes to, I mean, this is the way that I think that China has changed over the last 30, 40 years is that they've basically almost like selling a Hollywood version of the West where, oh, come into the city, get a car and do these things. Everything will be better. Well, actually, a lot of people in China have actually remained in the countryside and they're much less dependent on the financial system as a result.
Well, in actual fact, there's a lot of things to say about that. I mean, of course, the Chinese Communist Party did loads of really stupid things before they started their current policy. So, for example, the collectivisation and the creation of the People's Communes is an absolute disaster.
Stalin did the same, didn't he, actually?
Yes, he did, and it was stupid there as well. But, of course, what they've allowed to happen is they've allowed farmers to farm with state support. You're not allowed to just go to the city in China, unlike in India or Brazil, where you've got massive slums. There are no massive slums in Shanghai or Peking. Everybody lives pretty crowded, but it's bearable because not just anybody can go to the city. It's a much more controlled system. You were only allowed to have one child each, for example, and that includes the top bosses in China. Unlike here, where if you have a third child, you can't claim any benefits for them. But that doesn't apply, of course, to cabinet ministers or Boris Johnson, who sows his seed wherever he sees fit.
And what do you make of this whole idea that COVID may be some sort of a depopulation programme?
Well, if that's the case, it may well be the case that the problem they've got now in China is because of the one-child policy, they haven't got enough people coming into the workforce to sustain the growth rates that they've been getting. That's why they've released the one-child policy, and of course that never applied to ethnic minorities in China anyway, because they were given, like the Uyghurs, were given a special permission to have more than one child, because that was regarded
as... The Uyghurs?
Yep. Well, whatever you want to call it.
Pronounce it. Yeah.
But anyway, I'm not trying to defend 100% what the Chinese have done any more than I defend what the Cubans have done. But on the other hand, if you compare China to India, in India you still have 40 million people who are what they call manual scavengers. And that means their job is to go out and clean up other people's poo every day. In China, lots of people in India don't have access to modern flushing toilets. In China, that's just no longer the case. In China, you've now got a developing middle class, which is confident in its future and all the rest of it. And, of course, that's why the Americans, the US, want them taken down.
Well, I don't know if they are confident in their future. Maybe they've been persuaded
anymore.
To be. No.
No, well, then this is because...
Well, they've been sucked in the same way the West has been, into this kind of American dream, haven't they?
Well, no, it's not an American dream.
It's a Chinese dream. It's the same sort of thing. Material possessions, and you can do what you want, massive freedom.
Well, it's
but actually, it's almost a trap.
Well, it can be, but I think you could argue that in actual fact the Chinese have approached things in a rather more, you know, in actual fact they haven't been, it's not 100% free market economy. Yeah, there are social protections, not least, for example, the public healthcare system, which has responded pretty well to this crisis. I mean, they've had less than 4,000 deaths in the whole of China. That's 10 times less than Britain. Even though they've got to 25% of the world's population within their borders. Which is the more efficient system? Who's going to win in the end?
Join us in a minute as we take our weekly look around the world after some music from Media Bear.